so much for having me. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be invited someplace, you know, and it's always nice when, like, you get invited back a place when you, you know. And as we were doing the roll call, I was literally ticking off meetings, conferences that I've been to, you know, throughout this country, and I've been very privileged to have attended AA in almost every state that's represented here, with the exception of Utah. Yeah, which is really cool, right? So let me start with my sobriety date is September 4th, 1994. I'm that old. My home group is the Just for Today group in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. And I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I believe in sponsorship. I start all talks with those three things, because you got to stop drinking, you got to get a home group, and you got to get a sponsor and work the steps, and if you want to stay here. You know. So, now I'm done, right? No. So, I love speaking at WIPOG conferences. I mean, in fact, it's like my favorite thing to do. I've spoken at all kinds of different things, Big Book, Fellowship of the Spirit, but I love WIPOG, because WIPOG saved my life. I would not have stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous if it wasn't for the Garden State Young Persons Conference. I wouldn't have stayed if it wasn't for Essex County Young People. Because when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw my parents. And I was kind of pissed at them, you know? Because I had this delusion that they caused my alcoholism. And they kept dropping me off at places like rehabs and stuff, you know, saying no, taking shit away. So like when I walk into a room and there's people who look like my parents sitting there, like, I'm not talking to you. I'm not listening to shit you gotta say. I kind of hope you're going to die. So I sit in the back, I think at you, and then I go get drunk. That was my experience with traditional Alcoholics Anonymous. I am somebody who actually died while being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I overdosed and died at 16 years old while I had a coffee commitment, I had a sponsor I never called, a home group. There's something that I didn't do, which was work the steps, which is, you know, like kind of an insane thing if you think about it. I'm a member of a 12-step program, but I don't work any steps. Seems kind of strange to me, but when I got sober, people didn't talk about the steps. They didn't work the steps. They didn't do that sort of stuff. And what really makes me happy about what Alcoholics Anonymous is today as compared to where it was when I got sober is the fact that a speaker like me, who talks about the steps in God, because you don't want to hear about what happened when I was drinking, because you all know how to drink. We all know how to drink. It's about how do I stay sober, and how do I live a life that I want to have? And it's not about being miserable, because we are not a glum lot. As reflected by our behavior in the past hour, we are not glum at all, right? If getting sober meant sitting at home and knitting, I would have hung myself a long time ago. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a bigger life than I could have imagined. All I had to do is give up everything, alcohol, right? So I love doing this, and I love the fact that I'm chosen to speak, because it means that Alcoholics Anonymous has now become a place where people actually work the steps. And people actually crack that book, they own a big book, and that recovery and recovery-oriented talks are mainstream. That's amazing, and you know where they're mainstream? In WIPOG conferences. 6 years ago, I was the Friday night speaker at Icky Pond. And what, you know what I talked about? God and the big book? I talked about the steps. I talked about dying an alcoholic death in Alcoholics Anonymous, and having been 2 years abstinent from alcohol, wanting to die when somebody finally handed me a big book and gave me a solution for the problem that I have had my whole life. So I'll tell you a little tiny bit about who I am so you can just kind of get the gist of it all. I'm one of five kids. I grew up in Essex County, New Jersey. That's right. My mom was an administrative person at Rutgers University. My dad was a truck driver on the baby. Now, we have five kids.
Four of us
qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I dropped my sister off at rehab last week and then had a 302-er on Wednesday. 302 means like when you kind of involuntarily commit somebody. So alcoholism runs in my family. I'm really not kidding about that. I actually did that on Wednesday. So, alcoholism runs in my family, and I'm the baby. So I grew up in a place where beating the crap out of each other, smoking crack in the bathroom, drinking like a fish was pretty normal. The only thing that you had to do was not let anybody know what was going on in the house. Don't tell the neighbors. Kill each other, stab each other with rusty screwdrivers, but don't ever talk about it. My poor parents, you know, were raised by alcoholics. My grandfather's an alcoholic on my mother's side. My grandfather's an alcoholic on my father's side. My poor parents were essentially ill-qualified for raising the, you know, four demon spawn that they had, you know, and the one normal person, my sister Maureen, she's the oldest. She abuses alcohol because she doesn't finish it. Did you know wine goes bad? Did you know that? She was like explaining to me one day. She was like, so I had this bottle of wine on my counter and it went bad, it turned to vinegar, and I looked at her, I said, why the fuck would you do that? And then she looked at me and she was like, well, I didn't drink it. And I thought, that's completely insane. Why would you buy something and not drink it? I mean, I don't understand obtaining alcohol and not consuming it. That just seems completely ludicrous. But my sister doesn't drink like I do. She doesn't have the same relationship with alcohol that I do. You know, her kids do, but not her, right? So this is a little bit of my history, but here's the bottom line, is I'm not an alcoholic because I had crazy brothers and sisters. I'm not an alcoholic because my dad was an abusive Irishman. I'm not an alcoholic for any of those things. I'm an alcoholic because I have a physical craving, I have a mental obsession, and a spiritual malady. Now, all of that shit added to it, right? It definitely did. Like, you know, when you kind of grow up in the kind of in the household that I grew up in, where like dining room chairs get thrown across the, you know, at you, where like you hide under your bed on a pretty regular basis, you know, where you fall down the stairs pretty often. When you kind of experience those things, like drinking looks like a really good idea. So the first drink I had, I was actually 4 years old. I remember it. It was the best day of my life. I was wearing white tights, a green jumper, it was crushed velvet, I remember it. I looked like little Laura Ingalls, because I'm old. And I had a little lace collar and a little bow in my hair and patent leather shoes, and my brother let me have a sip of his drink. And I remember taking the sip, and it was just like white wine or something. And I remember thinking, this is the best thing I have ever done. I remember that. I remember exactly where I was. I can picture my parents' dining room table. And it was Thanksgiving, because it was a salient moment for me. It was a moment when I knew exactly what I was going to do for the rest of my life, which is put that stuff in my body. And I did. So I, you know, was the table shark, and I sipped everybody's drinks. And trust me, they passed out and left stuff around, man. I didn't have to work too hard to drink as a young child. So by the time I was 13 years old, I was a full-blown alcoholic. I didn't know that I was, but I was. I had full-blown DTs at 18. I thought that I had like some sort of super flu, and I honestly believe that the government created a super flu to kill alcoholics and addicts, and that they had infected me with it, and that's why I was so sick. My sponsor said, no, you're detoxing. I hadn't really let myself detox. I just kind of stayed nice and good for a long time, so I hadn't experienced it. I was like, oh, that's what they're talking about, DTs. Oh, okay. Paranoid and crazy. So that's a little bit about Carrie. So I've been in 9 rehabs. I've been dead twice. I've had multiple suicide attempts. I've been in the quiet room more times than I can count. 4-point restraints are something that I'm familiar with. Yeah. I bit a cop in my parents' living room while being hogtied in front of my mother, right? So these are things that I experienced, and I'll tell you that the day that I got sober wasn't the worst day of my life. It really wasn't. It was just another day. I had been out and running for a while. I was living in a crack house in East Orange. You know that you're a really bad alcoholic when the crackheads kick you out, right? Like, they were like, dude, you talk too much. They're like, sit down, you know, because, like, you know, alcoholics, like, we move around a little bit until we pass out, right? So I'm liquidated, and I'm talking to people. I'm bringing homeless people back to the crack house that we're living in. And they're like, you're bringing people back. You're touching my shit. Don't. So they threw me out. So then I was, like, super homeless. I wasn't just squatting homeless. Yeah. So, like, I used to break into people's basements, and I met my husband, right? We've been married for 24 years. We both had the same clean date. He was supposed to be here with me, but he actually just switched jobs, and he was, like, responsible and didn't want to take the weekend off. I was like, wow, you are an adult. This shit works. But anyway, so when I met him, I was 17, and he was 24. What he said to me was that he ate 200 hits of acid one night, and that, he wasn't sure if I was real, but if I was, that would be awesome. And I thought, oh, you're perfect. That'll really piss off mom. He was an ex-con. He spent 2 years in prison in California. He was on parole, but he said, you know, don't worry about it, honey. My parole's going to be up soon. And I thought, you're a keeper. We met in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He was 3 days off a binge, and I was eating Xanax and Klonopin and celebrating clean time. Yeah, we all know. Yeah, exactly. So I went home with him. So he was living in his ex-girlfriend's basement. Yeah. So he had this couch and this stuff down there. It was, like, pretty cool, though. It was a nice hippie pad with all these, like, tapestries and shit. He had, like, his stereo set up. The only thing is that, like, during the day, we couldn't be there. People would do laundry and be like, who are you? Why are you living in my apartment building? So he took me back to his ex-girlfriend's basement, and I never left. You know, I just took my hefty bags and my crazy and my bottle of Jack, and I moved in. It was great. You know, and that's when we decided to move to East Orange to squat in the crack house, and then we got kicked out, and then we kind of wandered around a little bit. You know, but I had been in and out of AA for so long, I really didn't believe it worked. Because I had never worked any steps, I'd never really got God. I hated God. Like, I blamed God. I thought it was really fucked up that God gave me alcohol and took it away. I was like, you gave me alcohol, solved every problem I had, and then you're making me, like, not do it anymore? Like, I thought that was cruel and abusive. So, like, I wasn't good with God. So I was pissed at God, and y'all talked about God all the time. You know, you talked about, like, taking a moral inventory and doing stuff like that. And I felt like, you know, I honestly believed that basically I didn't owe amends to anybody, that the people who hurt me should make amends to the people I hurt because it was their fault. I shared that once in a meeting. People laughed. Old-timers really laughed. They thought that was hilarious. They're like, you're so cute. You're really sick. Keep coming back. Okay, you know. So I lied and cried in AA for 5 years. Came in the front door and out the back, got drunk in the bathroom, and did all of that stuff. And then one day, I woke up in my husband's ex-girlfriend's basement. And it was the night after his 25th birthday. And I was like laying on this floor. At some point I had fell off the couch and I was just laying on the bare cement floor in a pile of my own vomit. I'd pissed myself, the usual, you know. That was kind of like, you're kind of like, especially alcoholic women, because, like, it's a little bit harder for us to urinate when we're drunk, right? Because we fall over a lot, you know. So, you know, like, alcoholic women know about carrying 2 or 3 pairs of underwear, having extra pants. Like, if you're really going out to drink, you bring extra pants and underwear. Like, you know. Or you're smart and you wear a dress, so you could just slip that stuff right off. Right? So, I woke up in a pile of my own vomit. I had, you know, peed on myself, like, quite a few times, I think. And I had this thought. You know, like, you ever, like, drink so much that, like, you're sort of not breathing, but you are? Right? where, like, you know, like, if you just lay wrong just a little bit, you would be dead. But it just so happened that, like, just a tiny bit of oxygen made it in, right? So, like, I woke up, and my chest, like, it hurt. Like, I was using, like, my, basically my, like, my, they're called intercostal muscles. I know that now. But I was using these muscles to breathe, and I was like, holy crap, like, if I just had, like, was laying a little bit to the left, like, I'd be dead right now. And I had that thought, like, that moment of clarity that, like, I'm gonna die. And for once, I, like, cared. I mean, I had always said I wanna die. I was like that girl, like, the girl you hate, right? Because, like, I dressed in black. Like, I put, yeah, I wore, like, Sharpie for, like, makeup, right? Like, the black, like, spikes, you know? Everything had safety pins in it and was infected and oozing, right? Because I did it all myself, right? I was really attractive. I was, like, 95 pounds. So I was skin and bones, basically infected piercings everywhere, Sharpie makeup, you know, just a prize. You know, so I went out, it's a complete shit show, you know, and so I kind of wake up and I'm having this experience, and I said, you know, I need to go back to AA. It was like the only place where people like didn't recoil from me. I mean, when I would show up to meetings, I mean, nobody was talking about steps of recovery or anything like that, but they'd give me a cookie. You know, like people wouldn't like go to the other side, because if you saw me coming, like you would go to the other side of the street. I mean, think about it. Some, like, you weren't sure if I had, like, you know, the plague or, like, what was going on with my face with all the infected piercings and, like, the Sharpie stuff that's, like, starting to ride up on my face a little bit. And, you know, I kind of smelled. I didn't brush my hair a real lot. I thought I was making dreadlocks, but I just didn't brush my hair. You know. And so I'd, like, roll into AA meetings, and, like, the old people would be, like, nice. I mean, I hated them. But, like, they would, like, give me a cookie. They would, like, did you eat honey? Like, they didn't, like, throw me out. So, like, when I woke up on the floor that morning, I thought, like maybe I need to go back to AA. Like, I know it doesn't work, but at least, like, there'll, like, be a place for me to, like, get some food. Or maybe, actually, I honestly thought that I could, like, kind of dope fiend and manipulate people into having a place to stay for a little while so that I can, like, clean up a little bit so I can go back on another run. That was my intention. I really didn't plan to get sober the day that I did. And I had nothing to do with staying sober, I really didn't. That truly was a grace of God. So, September 5th, 1994, I walked into a meeting and stole a big book. I have since given out hundreds and hundreds of big books to replace that one big book I stole. And I walked to another meeting, and I walked to another meeting, and then that ex-girlfriend that my husband, like the basement that we were living in, she actually let me sleep on her couch. Because that's kind of like, when we say principles of personalities, like I think that's a really good example of that, is your ex-boyfriend's like infectious, creepy girlfriend, you let her sleep on your couch. He still had to sleep in the basement, but I got to come inside. You know, and I kicked around Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years. In that time, I you know, it's weird, if you eat a cookie or something, like, you know, it's very easy to get pregnant. So I managed to get pregnant and have a baby by the time I was 10 months sober. Yeah. Actually, it was a real big thing where we were like, There was like a week where like either my daughter was conceived while I was smoking angel dust and drinking like a fish, or detoxing. So my first year, like my higher power was the, you know, the unborn baby in my, you know, growing inside of me. I didn't really believe that I could stay sober, and I didn't really believe that I was worth being sober. But I knew that I had to at least not do something to that child, and I loved her. So the only thing that really kept me sober during that year was the fact that I got pregnant. You know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself and presented a circumstance that I couldn't rationalize drinking or, you know, leaving AA. And it was weird because, you know, like, I wrote a four-step that was like IKEA four-step. It had like three columns, right? You know, like, I don't read stuff, like, I just look at the picture. So I wrote a 3-column inventory about what everybody did to me and how it affected me, and I wondered why I was still angry. Didn't do a fear inventory, didn't touch a sex inventory, didn't touch anything like that, harms or nothing like that. But I was trying. But, you know, the steps in Big Book really wasn't a thing back then. There was like a dark period of AA that, you know, began in the 80s and kind of progressed through the 90s. Towards the end of the 90s, like, there was this resurgence of, you know, steps in recovery. But for a long time, like, people went into meetings and just talked about their problems. Talked about, like, the topic of the day. And I don't give a fuck about what's going on in your life. I just don't. I'm selfish and self-centered. I think about myself. I don't want to hear about your problems. So I'd go into meetings, and people would talk about their dog or the divorce. And, like, you would know exactly what they're going to say, right? Like, you know what that guy who's angry about his boss is going to say, because he's been saying it every Friday night for the past 6 months. So, like, and I literally, you just, like, mouth the words and kind of, like, and I muscled through that. And at about almost 2 years stark raving insane, but without a drink, I was more suicidal and unhappy than I had ever been in my life. You know, I started to do things like call members of my family and be like, so, you know, when I die, can you take care of my daughter? And they're like, what? Like, I was like, I'm just having these, you know, I'm thinking, I'm just trying to be responsible. What I was really doing was I was deciding that I was going to drink again, and I knew that drinking meant that I was probably going to die, and I wanted to make sure that my daughter would be taken care of. Because deep down inside, I was dying. I was dying of untreated alcoholism. And at that point, I was 20 years old, and I had been in AA for 7 years. And I had no idea what was wrong with me, and I couldn't understand why all these people were happy, and I was dying. I'd go to meetings, and people would laugh, and they'd be joyful, and I'd be like, I fucking hate you. I hope you die. Like, I don't understand. Like, you're happy, I'm dying, and then you're sitting there, and you're talking to me, and you're, like, saying these slogans, like, one day at a time, or, like, just let it go. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. Like, I don't know what that means, because I'm not capable of that. So when you say, turn it over, I'm going to punch you in the face. That's what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to set you on fire. You know. No. I mean, so I'm sitting in these meetings, and somehow I ended up in Staten Island. And thank God for Staten Island. I mean, that entire island is pretty much a garbage dump. But I love Staten Island, you know. So, like, my husband got a job out there, and so we moved to Dungan Hills. And so you got this Jersey girl in Staten Island. And I start going to these meetings, and I get a sponsor. So my sponsor was, you know, having an affair with a married man. Yeah. And she, like, you know, she thought about the steps sometimes. She told me what she was going to do when she worked them. And I turned my will and my life over to the care of this woman. So we were just miserable bitches together, basically, and hated everybody. So one night when I was really suicidal and contemplating either climbing a bell tower with a deer rifle or drinking myself to death, she calls me and says, hey, there's this guy coming in from the West Coast, and he's speaking at this meeting called Common Solution. And, like, we hated these Common Solution people because they showed up with big books and stuff, and they would talk at us like we were stupid. And they would say things. They had all those catchphrases, like sunlight of the spirit and, like, real alcoholic and, you know, untreated alcoholism. We hated them. They, like, wore ties. They all came in, like, clusters, and they invaded our meetings and told us we were doing it wrong, you know. So she was like, hey, let's go to their meeting because this guy is going to speak. And it's like, let's go and let's hate on them. Let's judge the crap out of this group. The holy rollers. We call them the big book Nazis. Yeah. So we went to this meeting, and this guy, now if Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby had sex and had a love child, this is what this guy would look like. Like the handlebar mustache, everything, right? So he's sitting there and he's talking about the 9-step. And what he's saying in this 9-step thing is that when we talk about making amends to the moral, that we're not others, right? So what it means is that, like, when I make amends to somebody, it's not about whether it's going to cause me some inconvenience, that it's about, like, setting right the harm that I put out into the world. And clearly, I was not in agreement with that. Because I felt like, look, the world owes me. My life sucked. My dad beat me. I've been raped. I've been molested. I've lived on the streets. Terrible things have happened to me. If you had my life, you would drink too. So I felt like I didn't owe anybody amends because it wasn't my fault. So I raised my hand and said that in the meeting. With a lot of F words, with a lot of F words. More F words than I say tonight. So he laughed, right? Like you guys laugh. You're like, right? And you know that's that laugh with that, like, because I do it now. Like when I listen to somebody who's so insane, right? There's like the ism is oozing out of their pores, but you know that they're on the brink and the cusp of this next place because you can't get any crazier than where they are, right? And so he laughs, right? And he just says, hey, you know, I'll talk to you after the meeting. And I'm like, oh shit, I'm in trouble. Like Captain Kangaroo is gonna yell at me, right? And what he does is he pulls me aside and he asks me what happens when I drink. I'm like, I drink, I don't know, like, freaking drink. And he's like, well, you know, did you ever try to stop? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, what happens? I'm like, I drink. I try to stop drinking and I drink. I drink when I drink. I can't stop drinking when I start. All I do is think about drinking. I'm thinking about drinking right now. In fact, I'm salivating. You know, what more do you want to know? And he says, well, you know, how do you feel when you're not drinking? I'm like, empty? Like, my soul is made of razor blades and broken glass. And he smiled at me. And I didn't think it was funny. I don't know what he was smiling at. But he smiled because he had qualified me. I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years before anybody had ever asked me about whether or not I was actually an alcoholic. They all just assumed because I was there that I was one. But here's the thing, is that when you answer that question, when you concede to your innermost self that you are an alcoholic, it means I have a responsibility for my recovery now. See, when I'm in that place where I'm an alkanaut, right, and I'm not an alcoholic, right, so I'm an alkanaut, and I'm around AA, right? I don't gotta do this stuff. I don't have to live on a spiritual basis. I don't have to treat my alcoholism. But when you have that moment, when you know who you are, and you know what you got, but you also know that there's a solution there, I have but one choice, one real choice, one viable option, which is to treat my alcoholism. So when he sat down with me and asked me those questions and pronounced me and said, you know, it sounds like you're an alcoholic. Do you want to treat your alcoholism? What are you willing to do? Are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism? And in that moment, I was convicted of something. And I said, yes. I didn't know what I was saying yes to, because if he had told me what it was going to require, I was not going to do that. But in that moment, God moved me. And I said, yes. And so he got me another big book because I had lost the one I stole. And he hooked me up with somebody. His name is Tommy. Tommy sat down and started reading the big book with me. And I began to have an experience with the steps. 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous before I worked a step. Today, that wreck of a girl, right? So I came in here 95 pounds, thought Sharpie was eyeliner, loved to put holes in my face and body parts with nails and pins and all kinds of things. I didn't have a high school diploma. I was kicked out of 5 high schools. I was actually kicked off the short bus, right? So, like, the school for the emotionally disturbed said, you need to leave because you set too many fires. I liked fire. This was me. You know, like, I literally just had absolutely no success and nothing in my life. And I began to have an experience with these steps. And just something magical happened. Like, it's like my world was so tiny, and I was so claustrophobic, and all of a sudden, like, this brand new thing came into view. Now, I wouldn't have stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous if it wasn't for the YPOD, because that gave me something to do in a place where I felt like I was. And I would not have been able to hang on for as long as I did, because I would come in, I'd get a month, I'd get 30 days, I'd get 60 days, I'd get 90 days. I mean, I had more 90-day pins than, you know, I mean, like, then I can, you know, that I could possibly count. I mean, they're, like, at this point, they're gone. I've given them all to sponsees. I'm like, here's a 90-day pin that I was lying, celebrating 90 days for, right? You know, I would get some time together, but I could never stay sober. Because I didn't understand that when you have to straighten out spiritually before you straighten out mentally and physically. So I was trying to treat a spiritual problem with everything but spiritual living. And so as a result of that, I was dying. There's a line in our book, and it's one of my favorite lines. It says, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It says that may be obscured by calamity, fucked up shit, right? By pomp, ego, pride, by worship of other things, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? It could be obscured by all of those things, but underneath all of that, it's there. And my experience has been I looked everywhere for God. I looked for God in men, I looked for God in food, I looked for God in booze, I looked for God in drugs, I looked for God in everything, money, everything, except for inside myself. Because I hated myself. So, like, it was impossible for me to look for God within me, because I felt like I was a cesspile of human garbage. There's actually a line from Fight Club, which I love. It's actually, my alter ego is Marla, by the way. Yeah. And she talks about being infectious human waste. Right? She says, that girl's infectious human waste. I remember when I heard that line, I was like, mm-hmm. That's exactly how I felt about myself. But that feeling that I'm infectious human waste, that actually, my sponsor told me that was actually pride and ego. I was so invested in being sick that my whole identity was in being sick, that I couldn't even possibly entertain that it was possible to get better. And that my preconceived notions and limitations that I placed on AA and God were the things that were keeping me sick. So I started having an experience with the steps. And one of the things that I did was that I had a sponsor, eventually moved back to New Jersey, and I got a female sponsor. And she was an educator. She actually worked at Ramapo College. So I'm doing some inventory, and I'm doing some harms inventory on, like, institutions and stuff. And, it was, like, my high school, you know, the places where I set a lot of fires and did a lot of stuff, you know, and the cop I bit in front of my mom, things like that. And she was like, you know, you have to make amends for that. I'm like, no. I was like, I don't feel like I have to make an amends to a teacher for being a jerk. I mean, like, that's their job. And she's like, well, no. She's like, and you have to make amends to that cop. I'm like, I feel like I had a right to assault a cop who was trying to hog time me. I don't understand where that would be harm. I mean, that was his job, that was my job. I bit him, he was there. And she said, no, you actually have to make amends. So my high school principal was my sister Maureen's homeroom teacher. The perfect sister who, like, abuses alcohol because she doesn't drink it, right? So she's 16 years older than me. And so the day that I was born, she came into school and she was like, Mr. Orsini, I had this baby sister named Carrie. So then 16 years later, when I show up in his school setting fires and stabbing things, he's like, your sister Maureen, she's so beautiful and wonderful, and she's a nurse and went to college and didn't stab things or pierce things, and she's so successful, and I remember the day you were born. Why can't you be more like your sister? And I hope you die. Please die. And I said some pretty inappropriate things, ended up in school suspension or suspension on a pretty regular basis. So my sponsor said I owed this man an amends, that he was trying to help me. He was trying to connect with me, and my response was to be verbally abusive. So I write this letter of amends to the faculty of my Bloomfield High School, and I go in and I make an appointment and I sit with Mr. Orsini. And Mr. Orsini takes my amends and I ask him what I could do to set it right. And he goes, well, did you ever go to college? I'm like, no. He's like, well, did you ever graduate high school? And I'm like, no. He's like, do you have a GED? No. So he's like, well, what you can do to set it right is get a GED and go to college. I thought that wasn't fair. I was like, no, I gotta make a donation or something, or like weed the lawn or some shit. Like, I'm not going to college. Like, the last time I was in school, I got kicked off the short bus. Like, they told me to stop coming back to the delinquent school. Like, there's no way I was gonna do school again, right? But I went and told my sponsor, and she's like, well, I guess you have to sign up for the GED. I'm like, what? No. I made my amends. I don't have to do what he says. And she's like, yes, you do. So I was too scared to take the GED because I kind of felt like I was really stupid. Because I felt like I was a worthless, unlovable human being. And I was so terrified of failure that it paralyzed me and prevented me from doing anything. So I had this, I was getting this experience with the steps in God, but at the same time, I was crippled by fear, right? Because do you know what courage means? It means wholehearted. That's what it means. So when you're courageous, it's not that you're not afraid. It means that you go into something wholeheartedly. I didn't know that. So what happened was, is I was living this life where I was in AA and I was talking about all the wonderful things AA had done for me, but I wasn't actually living a life. And I wasn't doing anything. And I was afraid. So what I did was I signed up for community college. And I lied and said I had a GED that I didn't have. And I said, well, if I fail one class, I don't have to do it anymore, right? So I took a class and I didn't fail it. I got an A. And I was like, oh, great, now I got to take another class. So I took another class and I didn't fail it and I got an A. 2 years later, I'm graduating with a 4.0 GPA. And they're like, hey, by the way, like, where's your diploma? I'm like, oh, shit, I guess I got to take my GED. So I actually got my GED like 2 months before I graduated college. But I wouldn't have done that if it wasn't for the amends process. That wasn't on my radar. I wasn't about to go. I was going to say, do you want fries with that for the rest of your life? Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I didn't believe that I was capable of doing anything more. And so by virtue of the amends process, this whole avenue of life was opened up to me. So, you know, I ended up going to big girl college and graduate school, graduating at the top of my class, summa, while raising 4 kids and working full time. And I found out something. I'm not stupid. And all of those stories that I told myself about who I was turned out to be lies. Lies that I told myself because I was afraid. The greatest piece of this recovery process I ever received was an understanding of the role of fear in my life and its connection to my untreated alcoholism or my agnosticism. Right? Fear, essentially, when it talks about fear being the corroded thread that runs through our lives, right, and it classes it with stealing, what I think that the book was trying to tell me was that fear steals from me. It prevents me from living my life wholeheartedly. It prevents me from living my life courageously. And what it does is it traps me in this prison. Because all the things that I have to do to protect myself from the things that I'm afraid of actually produce the very things that I'm afraid of. So what I do to protect myself from being abandoned actually perpetuate my abandonment, right? That thing on page 60 and 63 when it talks about the actor, right? Trying to run the whole show and the scenery and the ballet and the lights and yada, yada, yada. What it's really talking about is saying the things that I do in order to keep myself safe, to avoid feeling threatened, avoid being afraid, actually keep me in a place where people can't ever get close to me, they never really know me, and I feel abandoned and alone. This process has given me the opportunity to connect with people on a level that I never thought I could. I've gotten the privilege of sponsoring hundreds and hundreds of women. I can't tell you that I can see God working through other people more precisely than I can see God working in my life. So when I sit down with another woman and we read the big book and we work some steps and I see God doing for her what she can't do for herself, that gives me the, like, essentially the fuel or the strength to support me in the times when I'm afraid, when I don't know what to do, when I'm in crisis. So essentially, that true spiritual awakening happens in the 12th step when we're carrying that message and when we're being vessels for God and the healing power of God. Now, if you take the word God out of the big book and you replace it with the word love, it still makes sense. So when I think of God, I'm really saying love. I just use God because it's easier than saying love. Because when I say love, people look at me and go, what? You know. My husband likes to call his higher power Sam, sure ain't me. You know, yeah. You know, but the idea here is this, is that getting a relationship with something that's greater than myself and seeing myself as being a part of the creation rather than being separate from has enabled me to live a life that I couldn't possibly imagine, you know, or become somebody that I didn't know that I could be. Something that recently happened in my life was that my dad passed away May 22nd of this year. My dad was an angry, very violent man. Grew up in a time and an era, he was 84 when he died. Grew up in a time and era where, like, beating your kids on a pretty regular basis was considering good parenting, you know. So, you know, it was a little, you know, it was a little rocky for a little bit when I got sober and I kind of had to work through my own feelings in regards to my father. But, you know, I did that amends, and I wrote plenty of inventory on him, and yada, yada, yada. Years later, you know, our relationship was able to be a normal father-daughter relationship, and all the anger and resentment I had towards him was removed. So, on his birthday, actually, he had a stroke. He had a massive stroke. And I got the phone call from my sister, and I went running down to the hospital. And the stroke destroyed over, you know, 50% of his brain. But unfortunately, the part of his brain that was still working was the part that keeps his heart and lungs working. So essentially, the stroke was so bad that the neurologist essentially said that it would have been more humane if it had actually killed him. So my family's a little crazy, and I just told you I committed my sister, so, you know, she's kind of crazy. And so, you know, I got the brother who smokes crack and the sister who drinks like a fish, and I got all that other stuff going on. So, you know, all of a sudden, everyone's looking at me, I'm the baby, and looking at me and saying, well, what do we do, Care? So I had the privilege of sitting up with my father for 24 hours holding his hand because he kept waking up not knowing where he was in the hospital without being able to move and not knowing what happened and blind. And I had the privilege of sitting with that man, holding his hand, and telling him that he was okay. I had the privilege of changing my father's diapers while he was on hospice. I had the privilege of feeding him the thickened apple juice while he was dying. I had the privilege of being there for him in his last moments, in his last hours. That was a privilege to me. I had the privilege of being there for my mom while she lost her husband of 59 years. I had the privilege of being there for my brothers and sisters while they lost their father. I had the privilege of being a good daughter, a good sister, and a good person for my family. And every single one of my brothers and sisters, my people, have come to me at different points and said, my God, how did you handle all of us and our crazy? And I looked at them and said, that's what AA teaches you. You might want to try and come, guys. You know, maybe if you come on over here and kind of do a little bit what I'm doing, you won't be so crazy smoking crack in the bathroom and torturing people at the funeral. You know, you won't throw yourself drunk on your dead father. Like, just saying, like, you know. But AA has done that for me. Like, I could not have done that for my family, and I couldn't have done that for my father. And I'll tell you what, when it talks about in the 10 step, when it talks about the 10 step promises, and it says that the temptation that will be removed, right? That will be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I gave my father the fatal shot of morphine. I didn't drink. And I didn't want his morphine. My brothers and sisters were stealing his pills left and right, but I didn't. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for you. Is that you can stand there at your father's deathbed and you can be giving him the drug that you really like. And you can not want to take it. That is the power, the healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that you can go through that experience with a sense of gratitude and awe at being able to be present in the moment and love people at their most broken. That is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I can tell you about the money, the kids, the house, the this, the car, the degrees, the whatever. And that's all like bells and whistles and stuff, you know. But telling you that I can stand with my family, as crazy as they are, love them despite their brokenness, and watch my father die and be grateful for that moment, that is what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. But here's the thing, is you actually have to do it. Being in the meeting isn't being in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's being an alkanaut. Being in Alcoholics Anonymous means being in those three sides of that triangle. It means participating in the program of recovery. So like, if you want what we have, you actually have to do what we do. And that means going back to that principal that you called an F word a million, million times, or that cop that you bit, or paying back the money that you didn't want to pay back, or going into those stores that you shoplifted from and paying them back. It means writing inventory when you don't want to write inventory. It means doing prayer and meditation when you don't want to do it. It means sponsoring people when you don't want to sponsor people. It means answering the phone when you don't want to answer the phone. It means not having your life be about you. See, my life is not about me. My life is about who, what I can do for other people. The amazing thing is when I stay out of my own life and it's none of my fucking business, it's amazing what happens. It's amazing the things that come about. When I start thinking my life is my own business, that's when I start getting in trouble. So the bottom line here is that when I can constantly think of others and how I can help meet their needs, and I can bring the power of God, love, the direction of Alcoholics Anonymous, those principles that we carry, if I can bring them into my daily life and practice them, it doesn't take a lot of effort, man. Like a few minutes of prayer and meditation, a nightly review, I got an app for that. I'm just saying. I have a nightly review app. I literally voice text it, send it out, and then my sponsees get it like, man, my sponsor is crazy. I get text back, man, like, I'm so glad you're so nuts. I guess I make them feel better. I'd want to do something like that, right? Start sending your nightly review to your sponsees. They'll love it. And then they call you on shit, right? So then they're calling you up, right? And they're talking to you, and then you're like, you say something like, yeah, that was on your nightly review 2 days ago. And they're like, they you know, kind of store it together. Or try and have like as much enthusiasm for the steps and recovery as I did for drugs and alcohol, man. Right? Like, if you had a liquid, I would put it in my body. I would put it up my ass. I didn't care. Right? And then you're like, Carrie, why don't you try this prayer? I'm like, no. Like, hey, Carrie, why don't you go to the spiritual retreat? I'm busy. Hey, Carrie, why don't you try writing this piece of inventory? That's hard, right? I have this, my sponsees know, right? So, like, I have this sponsee, and she called me, and she was like, so I'm almost done with my second column. And I go, well, then why did you call me? She's like, well, I wanted to check in with you, let you know I'm almost done with my second column. I'm like, what are you doing right now? And she's like, well, I'm getting a pedicure. I'm like, well, if you have time to get a pedicure, you mean you didn't have time to write your second column? Call me when you're done. And she's like, she was like, but I just thought you'd want to know. It's like, I don't care what you're doing. I want to know where you are in the work. Because here's the bottom line. I'm not your drama manager. I'm not here to fix your life. I'm not God. I'm here to put your hand in God's hand. I'm here to teach you these principles, to model them for you, and allow you to have your own experience. It's not for me to deprive you of your experience or tell you what to do, because here's the deal. If I tell you what to do, then you can blame me, and I'm not taking any of that stuff. Trust me. Like, I was like, oh, here's my advice, and then it didn't work out, and you're like, well, Carrie said, now I'm going to blame you. Hell no. I got enough blame, right? I got 4 kids. I got enough responsibility. I don't need yours. So, I mean, the bottom line with this, And I say this a lot, and I know that I'm like, you know, kind of all over the place, because I like talking about the steps, and I love talking about recovery, and I love talking about sponsorship, and I feel like people come in here, and they talk a lot about the first step, and no one talks about amends, nobody talks about 12-step, nobody talks about writing inventory, and then so we all know what it's like to be an alcoholic, we know what being an alcoholic looks like, but we don't know what recovery looks like, or nobody even, like, and by the way, I worked some steps and things got better. You know, but I like to talk about like what I did. So I was as enthusiastic about the steps as I was about alcohol. And so when somebody said, "Hey, Carrie, why don't you try a multiple fifth step?" I'm like, "Ooh, a menage a trois fifth step? I'm down. So I took a bunch of inventory, right? And at that time, I had about 8 years. No, maybe seven. I had about 7 years, and I took a bunch of inventory, and I got some sponsees together, because the whole thing was like to read inventory to somebody who had less time than yourself. So the challenge I got was like, hey, why don't you pick people with 2 years or less? So I got a handful of sponsees together, and I read them my inventory. And they tore me apart, because they'd been waiting, right? Like, think about it. You watch your sponsor, and you go, was that right? I don't know. She's doing it, so it must be right. But you kind of file that away, right? So I sit down. There's five of them. So there's four sponsees and a grand sponsee. And they tore me. I mean, I remember sitting there thinking, like, sit on your hands and shut your fucking mouth. Just don't say anything. Just nod and go, yeah. Right? So I did this inventory. And, of course, my mom's calling. It was probably about my sister. But anyway. So I did this inventory, did this fifth step, had this multiple fifth step, drove home. I was exhausted. I mean, like, I literally felt like I was, like, I had fought, like, 10 rounds with Mike Tyson. So, like, but you have to take that quiet hour, right? You know, because it doesn't count. Like, if you don't sit with what you just did and you just, like, go off, it doesn't count. You have to sit with yourself in that experience of having the shit kicked out of you by a bunch of girls telling you where you're wrong and what you missed in your fourth column, right? And then you got to sit in that and have that experience where you really want God to remove it. So I was sitting there and I was like, all right, well, I'm going to probably fall asleep. So let me go in the tub because at least, like, you know, like self-preservation, I don't want to drown. So I make this bubble bath, and I got these candles and this whole thing, and I'm in the tub, and I'm looking through my inventory, and I'm sitting with Quiet Hour of God and this thing, and I'm looking at this stuff, and I'm looking at 7 years how selfish and self-centered I was, and how dishonest, and how much I played God, and how broken I still was, and how much I worshipped outside things, and how much I was really looking for, like, human power to fill up that hole inside of me. And I remember, like, just wanting more than anything else God to just take it away. Like, I didn't want it because I wanted you to think I was awesome. I didn't want it because I just wanted to impress you or anything like that. I wanted it because I just wanted to feel clean. And I jumped out of the tub naked, got on my knees on my bathroom floor, and just begged God to please take it away. Just please take it away. And I had this profound experience where, like, it was a white light experience. And essentially, like, I kind of lost a little bit of time, and I just started writing. And I'm naked on the toilet writing. And I wrote this, like, essay. And I didn't know it was an essay at the time, but it was just this thing. It just came out of me. And then, of course, I, like, got dressed and went to bed and said, that was weird. And something shifted inside of me where I really embraced the concept of my creator. See, up until that point, I was my own creator. I was trying to play God and dictate what I looked like and what happened to me, and I was always invested in the outcome. And in that moment, I realized that in and of myself, I'm nothing. And that I had to absolutely abandon myself to this process, to the higher power that I have in my life, the higher power I don't understand. And I had to abandon myself to this and allow this process to do what it does. And all of a sudden, weird things started happening in my life. Like, the next day I went to the DMV in Wayne, New Jersey, and I sat, it was like July, right? And I was hot. I had two kids, because at that point I had two kids. Now I have four. But I was in line for hours with screaming children, and I wasn't angry. And I left, and I walked outside, and I was, like, grateful. And it was the first time I had experienced like gratitude, and not in the sense of I'm writing down things that I'm grateful for, but in the sense of gratitude as being a living prayer, where you carry gratitude with you, and in and of itself, the gratitude you carry is actually honoring your higher power in that moment. So bringing that great grateful attitude in itself is a prayer. It's a state of being. It's actually called walking prayer. And it was the first time I experienced that, and it was incredible. So I hope that just sharing with you some of the cool things that I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous and the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. And I'll kind of end with you with this, is that for me, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me back my life. It's given me absolutely everything that I am. And I can look in the mirror today and actually want what I have, not because what I have is awesome or because I'm egotistical in any way, but because I'm truly grateful for the person that I've become, because I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't me at all. It was the power of God and AA working in my life. But we have this thing where, like, we get things and they're good, and then we start to do this thing where, like, we start enjoying the things that are good and we forget to be members of AA, right? We forget to sponsor. We show up in our home group and we bitch with our friends and we don't talk to the newcomer. We drink coffee. We, you know, kind of do our thing and then we leave. And we forget that the very thing that gave us our lives, we owe a debt of gratitude towards. So I challenge you, sponsor. Carry this message, especially the women. Work with other women, man. They're a handful. I know they're pains in the ass. They whine all the time. Seriously. But if you're sitting in this chair and you haven't had a drink in your body and you have been introduced to the solution, that being the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you are not carrying this message, you're a selfish asshole. If you have a wax vagina and you have time to get a bikini wax, you have time to fucking sponsor. I don't want to hear that shit. And when I see the manicured, perfectly eyebrowed bitches walk in my home group with the nails and this, that, and the other thing, they tell me they don't have time to sponsor, I want to punch them in the face. My nails look like I've been chewing it, my legs were fucking hairy until this morning, but I sponsor women at Alcoholics Anonymous. We owe a debt to Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to pay it back. Because when you stop paying that debt to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what happens?
Die.
Exactly. So I want to thank you so much for having me.